This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And on our show today, Ashley Thornburg will get into food customs, culture, and traditions as part of a book with the title Everlasting Yeast. That's the translated title because it's a Germans from Russia food heritage book. And Ashley will be talking with the editor, Sue Balcom. We'll also hear from Heidi Sirwick on visiting writer Cheryl Strait at the UND Writers Conference. And Ashley will come back for our What's Happening calendar of events. But first, I learned a new word today, micropolitan. It's an important word for North Dakota because it's a term the U.S. Census uses to describe population areas between 10,000 and 50,000 people. For the second year in a row, Williston is the fastest growing micropolitan area in the nation. And this year, Dickinson is third, Minot is 25th. That's in the nation. That kind of growth is exciting and challenging. Today, we'll talk about how health care providers in the oil patch are coping with astounding growth in the need for their services. Joining us, Daryl Birch, CEO of the Coal Country Community Health Center in Beulah and the Sakakawea Medical Center, that's the hospital in Hazen. Thank you for joining us, Daryl.
Thank you for having me.
And also, Matt Grimshaw joins us. He's CEO of Mercy Medical Center in Williston. Thank you, Matt, for being with us.
Thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Daryl, let's talk a bit about your community health center. Who are your clients?
Our clients are community members that reside in our area or that are visitors passing through. We provide services to anybody that needs to seek primary care services in our
And how do they pay?
They pay in a variety of ways. We see people who have health insurance. We see individuals who have Medicare benefits. But we also see those who are either uninsured or underinsured, and we can provide services to them if they qualify for our sliding fee scale.
And how has all this affected your bottom line?
Well, in providing services, obviously we need to maintain profitability, but increased volume that we get from the patients that we are seeing and from the visitors that are passing through our area obviously helps contribute positively to our bottom line as long as we're able to manage the resources that we need in order to provide those services.
Give us a sense of how much your operation has grown, or not grown if it hasn't, in the last, say, 5 years.
Well, I think over the last 5 years at the health center, the number of patient encounters that we've experienced probably has grown 30 or 40%. We've obviously not seen the dramatic growth that areas such as Matt's area in Williston has seen that's in the heart of the oil activity, but we're close enough that we also get some of the spillover effects of that activity, and we see people traveling through our areas that are working in the oil fields or the truck traffic that's passing through. So we've seen an increase as well.
Matt, at Mercy Medical Center in Williston, what kind of growth have you seen in, say, 5 years?
As we look back to 2009 versus today, a couple of key metrics that I'll share. In terms of net patient revenue, how much we have collected for all services provided, we're up between 45 and 50% in total revenues. But it's even more dramatic within certain categories of the services we provide here. For example, our obstetrics, our OB women's health service line, our number of babies have more than doubled in those 5 years. Our ER volume has more than doubled in those same years, and our clinic visits are up about 65%.
Well, that's a fair amount of growth. How have you been accommodating that with your facility?
It's been a big challenge. We identified early on in 2010 that we simply did not have the space for several of our key growth areas, and we embarked on an aggressive facility master plan to meet those needs. And in late 2012, we opened the doors on our new outpatient surgery center and our new birthplace, which has allowed us to double our capacity both for surgery and OB. And then in the next 90 days, we'll start construction on an ER expansion that will double our ER. We've already increased it by 50%. Gone from 6 beds to 9 beds. Now we'll go from 9 beds to 18 beds, which is remarkable for a community of our size.
And what do you estimate the community size is now?
Well, no one study on the fastest-growing micropolitan area in America, and I think they estimate the city at 26,000 approximately. But we really look at a service area that has a mix of residents and workers, and our close-in service area is probably in the 40-plus thousand range when you factor in the temporary housing units within our county.
Okay. Darrell, you also are CEO of that hospital in Hazen. Have you seen an increase in the birth business and the emergency room traffic?
Well, we don't deliver babies here at our facility, but we've certainly seen a growth in our emergency room as well, as far as the number of patients that we're providing care to. And then also the intensity of what we're seeing in our emergency room in comparison to what it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. We're seeing a lot more accidents and trauma and those types of things.
Any difference in the nature of those accidents and those trauma patients?
Well, we're seeing much higher frequency of motor vehicle accidents and those kinds of trauma events.
Matt, when you think about the explosive growth in the oil patch and in Williston in particular, number one micropolitan area, it must be a bit of a challenge to get people there to go to work. Matt, are you there? I guess we've lost Matt, so I'll ask you, Darrell, how was your staffing handled?
Well, it's getting much more challenging to recruit the staff that we need, and then also to maintain a salary structure that's competitive with what's happening in the oil field and in the area around us. We're needing to do a much better job of recruitment. And then, of course, we want to remain competitive so that we can retrain the good staff that we have as well.
What kind of a salary differential are you competing with?
Well, it's not as significant, again, in our area as it is in some of the stories that we hear from the Williston's and the Watford City, where we hear that the Walmarts of the world or the McDonald's of the world are paying anywhere between $15 and $18 an hour for some of that staff. And so it's difficult for us in some of our positions to try to match those types of salaries and be able to afford to do so with the fixed reimbursement that we have from health care.
And that fixed reimbursement, is there anything in terms of legislation in Congress, anything that's happening at the state level that you're keeping an eye on in terms of your bottom line?
Well, I think we all are keeping an eye on what's happening at the federal level. Most recently, with sequestration going into effect, it's going to affect the reimbursement that we receive from Medicare for the services that we provide, with the across-the-board 2% reduction in payments for hospitals, physicians, clinics, nursing homes, for the services that are provided to Medicare beneficiaries. We are going to experience that reduction. So we're obviously paying attention to that, and that also whatever might happen with the continuing resolution and the changes in the budget.
Okay. Matt, we lost you temporarily. I wanted to ask you something that I was discussing with Darrell, and that is the challenge of recruiting doctors and other staff members for Mercy Medical Center in Williston.
It is our number one challenge. As we've been in recruiting mode actually before the oil boom began, and now as the world is paying attention to what's happening in Western North Dakota, people hear about Williston, but sometimes they don't actually hear the good things that are happening out here. So we actually find ourselves having to counterbalance some of the negative publicity, even to get people to think about coming out here. And that's just the first step. Then we have the challenges of housing, which we deal with every single day. We average on most days between 50 and 60 vacant positions. And those range from entry-level positions with limited educational requirements through the most experienced physicians on our medical staff, and the needs never seem to go away.
What kinds of specialties are especially needed?
Well, right now we are recruiting for family practice and internal medicine and pediatrics, so all three of the main primary care specialties. We are recruiting for emergency medicine physicians. As we've seen the growth here, we've seen the need for a higher level of training to keep up with the demands from the trauma side as well as just the volume that comes to our ER. We're also exploring what the opportunities are to provide better mental health services in Western North Dakota. We are talking about the need for cardiology services. We are beginning the recruiting process for another orthopedic surgeon to join our practice. And really, the list goes on. We're looking for an ear, nose, and throat physician. We lost one that we had here for several years, so we're aggressively interviewing for that. And on the nursing side, the challenge that many of us are having across the state is there just aren't enough experienced specialty nurses in North Dakota. And a specialty nurse would be labor and delivery, surgery, or ICU. There's just a statewide shortage right now.
You mentioned that there were some negative impressions that people you were trying to recruit had about the state, that they'd heard about it or had in their mind. What are those impressions?
I'm often asked by people, do you actually go to Walmart? Is it safe to go to shopping? And I tell them, of course I go to Walmart. Why wouldn't I go to Walmart? And that's just one example of some of the stories that have been shared about, they talk about crime. Isn't crime rampant? And we point to the data. And the data we've seen would indicate that the crime rate in Williston is actually still lower than Fargo, for example. And we are still well below the national average. Yes, we have a lot of traffic accidents due to the increased number of vehicles on the roads, but there's a perception out there that it's not safe to live in Williston, and we have to fight that because from everything we see and experience, it is safe.
Darrell, we're not just a booming state, we're an aging state. Are there challenges for senior care in your area?
Well, I think when we have challenges delivering health care in general, that includes the care that we provide to the aging population as well. But you know, there are long-term care facilities, especially located in the western part of the state, that are challenged finding enough resources and staff to provide care to those that are aging and want to stay in the communities that they grew up in. And they'd like to stay there, even if they need to be in a long-term care facility. But there are challenges out there for our state's nursing homes as well to provide care by having enough staff and the resources to do so.
Do you have any housing issues in terms of finding suitable places for people who work at your organizations to live?
It is getting much more challenging here as well as far as affordable apartments, or if you recruit some staff members to your facilities in order for them to find suitable housing that they may want to purchase, it's getting very challenging here as well. Though, again, I'm sure it's not like it is in the Williston or Watford City areas, but we, too, are experiencing those challenges here.
Well, Matt, tell us what it's like for you in Williston.
We identified about 2 years ago that housing was going to be the number one challenge. So we began working with our parent organization, Catholic Health Initiatives. And the good news is, we are right now building an $11 million apartment building in downtown Williston that is earmarked for really healthcare workers, be it Mercy or other entities in the community or other essential service personnel. And we hope to have it open September 1 as our goal. And while it's not low-cost subsidized housing, it is a much more reasonable price than what the market is currently bearing. So our goal is this summer we will start promoting that we have housing available, and as we are really recruiting nationally, we believe this is going to make a difference, that we will be able to recruit experienced individuals for some of our key positions because we will have nice, attractive, and reasonably priced living for this market.
That's kind of an unusual piece for the business model for a healthcare center, though, isn't it?
It's certainly outside the box. We never thought we'd be getting into the housing business, but we ended up renting where we have staff in them right now. The only way we can secure housing in many cases, if something comes available, we end up leasing it and then subletting it back to an employee, because if you wait until you have them hired, there's just unlikely that they're going to find a place to live.
Okay. Well, North Dakota is traditionally a hard work state. Farm work is not for the faint of heart, and certainly working in the oil patch isn't either. So is there growth in your physical therapy and occupational therapy area at the hospital? Did we lose Matt again?
No, I'm still here. Okay. We have definitely seen growth. We have added therapists to our staff. We definitely see a lot of injuries come through our both our emergency department and our clinic. We've added a full-time occupational medicine specialist to our clinic, and we see a lot of work-related injuries. I do have to give the oil and gas industry credit. We have definitely seen a reduction in the number of serious life-altering incidents as a percentage of work injuries than you would have in the prior boom. But we still see a lot of extremity injuries, that blunt force kind of events, a pipe, a chain, a hammer falling off something. It's really an everyday occurrence that comes through our hospital and our clinic.
This probably isn't in your area of expertise, but have you noticed anecdotally any increase in the number of chiropractors in the Williston area?
Yes, we have.
Okay.
They are very busy.
All right. Daryl, where you are in Beulah and the Hazen area, how far out do ambulances have to go to get somebody to an emergency room?
Well, there are points in time that they need to go out 20, 30 miles in order to respond to an accident. And I'm glad you brought up the ambulance services, Doug, because that obviously is a service that has been very challenged in western North Dakota. So many of our ambulance services are staffed by volunteers who have full-time jobs, and it's getting more and more difficult for them to continue to volunteer to provide those important EMS services to their particular communities. And our area is no different as well, too. With the increase in traffic, our service is seeing a higher incidence of issues and accidents that they need to respond to.
Well, I noted in a 2007 report that the state of North Dakota put together called the Rural Health Assessment, they had over 4,300 EMS personnel in the state, first responders they were, and of that 4,300 number, 3,900 were volunteers. So there is some stress on that population, particularly now 6 years later, I imagine.
There definitely is, and I think you're seeing more and more that ambulance services are needing to hire the staff that they need in order to continue to provide those emergency services. And the North Dakota legislature is being very responsive and attentive to those needs, and I think they're trying to help address some of those needs through some of the proposed legislation that might end up coming to fruition.
I don't know how delicately to ask this question, but do people die for lack of specialists in rural emergency rooms or for lack of, expediently getting an ambulance to an accident site and bringing that person back to an emergency room? Do we have those issues in North Dakota?
I certainly haven't seen or heard of those. Our EMS units are very responsive. They get those individuals quickly to facilities to be stabilized and or treated, and I don't hear that at all.
Matt, have you heard anything like that?
No, but that risk certainly exists. So two things that we have been successful on partnering here. One is we were able to work with Valley Med Flight, an air transport service out of Grand Forks, and they have located a plane, a fixed-wing medical transport plane here in Williston, which has really shortened the transport time for some of these life-threatening injuries to get patients to a higher level of care, whether that is in the state or to Minneapolis or Seattle or Denver in some cases. It has definitely improved transport times, and I have to think it has helped save lives. We are also working with Williston City Fire, which runs the local ambulance service, to see if there is an opportunity to partner with another organization to bring an helicopter into our community for that scene response. Because as you get out to some of these well sites, it might be straight line distance 30 miles from Williston, but it might take them 45, 50 minutes to get there. And if the weather's bad or roads are bad, it's even worse. So we are definitely monitoring.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Both of you, and I guess I'll start with Daryl first, there are a couple of bills in the North Dakota legislature that will directly impact your operations. The human services budget, that was House Bill 1012, is reimbursement for human services. And 1362 is Medicaid expansion, which is tied to the Affordable Care Act. So, Daryl, what's your take on those two things?
Well, certainly we hope that the Department of Human Services budget in House Bill 1012 gets passed and has adequate funding in order to continue to provide services to the Medicaid population. There are specific things that we're watching and following, and that would be reimbursement to critical access hospitals, also reimbursement to the rural health clinics in North Dakota. There's legislation included in there that would rebase rural health clinics to a more current cost of providing services. So we're paying attention to these so that we can have increased reimbursement for the services that we provide.
Well, I did notice that in a story that was published by Stanford University's Rural West Initiative back in late last year, you did mention that private insurers pay less in North Dakota than in most other states. Regional hospital margins are shrinking rapidly, you said.
Yeah, in a recent study that we did here just a few months ago, especially in western North Dakota, three-fourths of the hospitals are having some challenges and are operating at a deficit. And a lot of that is due to the changes in the cost of services we provide, et cetera. But yeah, it is a challenge, and so we continually advocate for appropriate reimbursement for the services that we're providing.
Matt, your take on these issues?
We have met multiple times with Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota. We've talked with the governor's office, worked with our local legislators on this topic multiple times, because as a state, we feel good that we have low insurance rates and we have controlled environment for increases, but sometimes that mechanism can't move fast enough when the market is changing like we are experiencing today. As we look back 5 years ago, most of us across the state in healthcare were assuming aging population, shrinking population, with the exception of a few small markets. Now in the West, we're experiencing a population getting younger and rapidly increasing, and with that, the cost to provide services is increasing at a much more rapid pace than reimbursement has been budgeted for. So something does need to give. We're pleased that what's being done on the Medicaid side, the expansion of Medicaid, while it might not impact Williston significantly, it certainly does impact the rest of rural North Dakota. And it's important that we do keep reimbursement for our critical access hospitals, because they really are the first line of defense in our small towns across the state to provide that health care in the local community that we must have.
Do you like Senator Heidi Heitkamp's idea for a mid-cycle census for North Dakota? You're in that micropolitan area that would be affected.
We absolutely support that, because there are uses of census data that potentially could punish us and hamper our ability to recruit physicians and nursing staff. For example, the classifications of a first pass of the data for our market would show that we would no longer qualify. But it's based on a census that was out of date the day it was published. And if there was a way to get new data, we absolutely support that.
Well, Matt, let me ask you the big question. What keeps you up at night about Mercy Medical Center?
The challenge of keeping high-quality staff and providing best-in-class care 24/7 in this environment. Absolutely, without question, that is number one.
Daryl, do you?
Exactly the same thing. We want to make sure that we have the resources available in order to provide care to those that entrust their lives to us, and that is a challenge for us.
How about getting some help from the medical school at UND? I know there are proposals in the legislature to train more doctors and provide additional facilities. I'm assuming you like that idea?
Well, statistics are out there, definitely, that if they're trained in North Dakota, they're more likely to stay and practice in North Dakota. So we are definitely supportive of that.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you both for speaking with me today. I noted when I went online and started doing a little research that you two have been asked a lot of questions by a lot of people. I found citations in the New York Times and, again, at Stanford University. So obviously, North Dakota's explosive growth and the need for those services to keep up are getting some attention. Thank you for joining us. Daryl Birch is a CEO of Cole Country Community Health Center in Beulah and the Sakakawea Medical Center in Hazen, and Matt Grimshaw, CEO of Mercy Medical Center in Williston. Time now for the news with Danielle Webster, and we've got a winter storm coming up.
We do. You know, Doug, I've got some details on that coming up, and also a few details, not many, because they're watching it, but we're in for another one in the later part of the weekend as well. So.
Well, when you're done, I'll tell you a little coincidental thing about our show.
All right. Sounds good. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Winter weather is moving into parts of North Dakota late this evening. The National Weather Service is issuing a winter storm watch for much of the Devil's Lake Basin and Red River Valley, a winter weather advisory for much of northern North Dakota, and a freezing rain advisory for many portions of southwestern North Dakota. Ken Samosko is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Bismarck and says a cold front is beginning to move into the northern areas of the state, which will begin to materialize into wintry conditions late this evening and persist into tomorrow. Samosko says another system will be moving into the area on Sunday and that the Weather Service is monitoring that closely. He says that system will be significant and affect most of the state. The vice chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee says while tougher DUI laws may help cut down on people driving drunk, mandatory minimum jail sentences for first-time offenders won't do much except clog the court system. Dickinson Republican Senator Kelly Armstrong talked to the House Transportation Committee about the changes made by his committee to the Senate's version of a DUI bill. Armstrong is a defense lawyer in Dickinson, and he told the committee a driver accused of driving drunk behind the wheel would be more likely to take the case to court.
Every time you put these minimum mandatories and significant minimum mandatories on a first offense, you're going to go to trial. And here's why you're going to go to trial, because the judge isn't going to sentence him more to the minimum mandatory anyway. So if you put a 10-day offense on a first offense DUI, which is a Class B misdemeanor, very rarely does a first offense Class B misdemeanor ever get any jail time, let alone a 10-day minimum mandatory. So as a defense attorney, I would never plead a DUI guilty again. I would be like, we're reducing to a reckless driving or we're going to trial.
Fargo Democratic Representative Ed Grichella is a co-sponsor of the original bill. He told the committee he looked at the DUI bill for deterrence, not punishment.
The average DUI arrested first-timer drives 80 times a year drunk. So when we see these people, we say we want to feel sorry for them. Oh, they just had one too many. You know, you hear that term. It's the first time he ever did it. No.
Another DUI bill passed by the House is pending in a Senate committee. Grichella says he's hoping a conference committee will come up with one bill that has elements of deterrence and punishment. And the state of North Dakota is partnering with a computer software developer, that's Microsoft, in what is being described as a digital alliance. Governor Dalrymple says the partnership is the first of its kind.
The real value of this relationship is being able to take advantage of all the wonderful tools that Microsoft has developed. Tools that are free, basically, for people, and take advantage of them in our schools, our universities, and also in our Department of Commerce as they develop programs for entrepreneurship. Part of this is getting these tools out to where people know they exist and learn how to use them.
State Superintendent Kirsten Baszler says the alliance teaches digital literacy through the education system and will also help foster innovation.
A strength of this project is that it has the capacity to reach all of North Dakota students, impacting every corner of our state, large and small, rural and urban. In addition, this project nicely aligns with our goal for the department, which is to have all of our students college and career ready when they leave that K-12 educational system.
The initial agreement will be in effect in the next for the next 3 years. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, Danielle, I was going to tell you about that. It's 72 years ago today, on this date in 1941, there was a devastating blizzard that hit the Red River Valley. So winter storms in March, as we know, are kind of traditional. And this one was historic. You'll hear about it from Merrill Pepcorn on Dakota Date Book.
Excellent. We'll be listening.
Okay. Ashley Thornburg joins me now because there's a new cookbook coming that's more than a collection of recipes. There are hundreds of anecdotes and photographs peppered in. And it's as much a preservation of the past as it is about food.
That's right. It is called Everlasting Yeast. Yeast, as you know, is an essential ingredient in baking. And when it comes to preserving culture, talking with family, especially the oldest living relatives, is key. Author Sue Balcom got a grant from the State Historical Society of North Dakota, as well as personal and business donations. And she just took the ball and ran with it. She conducted hundreds of interviews and even went digging through the trash for old photographs to put this together. And I spoke with her earlier today about her new book. We are here today to talk about food, family, culture, traditions, customs, and they really all come together so perfectly in your latest labor of love. And frankly, I don't trust that I would be able to pronounce this correctly in German. So why don't you tell me the name of your new book here?
Well, since I was of the generation that did not get to learn how to speak German, I'm not going to attempt it either. But the name of the book is actually Everlasting Yeast. There are three words that we came up with that mean everlasting yeast, but Ewinger's Thoughts is the one that we chose for the book title because it stands for eternal seed. Now, as you know, when you bake bread, you have no success unless you add that yeast, that living, growing thing. And so as descendants of the Germans from Russia, in a three-county area in North Dakota, Emmons County, Logan County, and McIntosh County, we as the everlasting seed or the eternal seed of these people are working really hard to preserve what we perceive as being pretty much the last full-blooded German-speaking citizens of North Dakota. And that would be like my parents and some of the other members' grandparents. And so we have kind of like dedicated ourselves to bringing people to come to this area and learn about this exciting culture of people who contributed so much to the state of North Dakota. In the cookbook, which is really kind of not a cookbook, it is actually a food culture history book, we talk about a time before electricity, a time when people canned with cow chip bricks and corn cobs to fuel their cook stoves. They butchered, and they started late in the year so that they could keep meat frozen over the winter outside in the shady areas of their yard. And then in the spring, about this time of year when that began to thaw, they would smoke that meat for Easter and then raise some more livestock and start the process over again. So it's a story. It's stories and memories of survival. It is stories and memories about food. It's actual recipes for things like everlasting yeast, soft soap, strudels, Nifla, Kugeln, all of those wonderful things that the Germans from Russia brought to this country. There's a chapter on threshing, and there is a wheat that is being brought back to attention called, they called it spelt, but it was actually emmer, and they brought it with them from Russia when they came over here. So it's an exciting culmination of homesteaders that came to North Dakota and brought with them a culture and a religion and their foodstuffs. And we just want people to know that these are great people, but they were humble people, and they never talked about this stuff. So this is an opportunity to share that with everybody.
Yeah, you really get a sense of how much work it was just to eat. I mean, that's something we really take for granted these days.
We certainly do. And not only that, but everybody was involved in a local food system back then. Everybody had a part to play, from the youngest child in the family to the elders of the community. And so in order to eat, you had to work. And while that might seem kind of strange to people nowadays because we live in such a fast food world, they ate absolutely nutritious, homegrown, I know where it came from kind of food, and they were very healthy, I think, because of it. I had a great Uncle Jake who passed away probably 3 years ago. He was like 106 years old. So they were good, hardworking people, but yes, most of the time they spent feeding themselves.
Sounds like these are as much recipes for life as just they are eating.
Well, I would hate to say this, but if ever there comes a time in this country where the interstate system is shut down for any amount of time, we'd better know how to feed ourselves. And nationally, there's a huge movement towards local food systems, which is kind of my other job. And so this tied in perfectly with what I work on normally, which is the small diversified family farm, which is what these people brought to this country. And of course, there are people that don't know that potatoes grow in the dirt. They only know them as French fries. And so this is a lovely, lovely book to tie into the local foods movement as well.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that people could harvest potatoes and have them really for a year. I didn't know potatoes lasted that long. It's stored properly.
Absolutely. And these people were masterful at these kinds of things. Plus, they knew how to pickle. They made sauerkraut. I actually have garlic and onions and fresh carrots and squash potatoes left from my garden last year. So those kinds of things, those skills we feel are so important to pass down to the next generation before they're gone. My parents are in their 80s. I have probably 28 or 29 living aunts and uncles, and it has always been a goal of mine to ask them how they lived on those farms and how did they survive, even before electricity and during the Depression. And so these, I'm telling you, when I read these stories, I hear their German accents, and it just brings tears to my eyes because some of these stories are so heartwarming. Some of them are so funny, but they're so German from Russia. It's just about the best project I've ever been involved in my entire life. And I'm old.
In doing all of this research, was there anything that surprised you?
What surprised me the most about this project was the similarity in these families and yet the cultural differences even amongst the Germans from Russia. Something that I learned that I never knew, this is how close-knit these communities were, that the Protestants or the Lutherans settled near Wishick in the McIntosh County area, and the Catholic faction settled down in or over in Linton and Emmons County. And so they actually had words that were different between the two religions within this little community of Germans from Russia. So it was pretty amazing when I come across something that's called Dungus. And I'm like, what is that anyway? And one of my cousins is like, well, you wouldn't know that because you're not Catholic. It's the Catholic word for gravy made out of ketchup and cream. Which sounds horrible, but I heard it was really a wonderful
dish.
I did
make a face. I'm not going to lie. That doesn't sound that good.
So in addition to, you know, collecting all of this stuff, now we're starting to kind of like share how to actually cook some of these recipes. Because, you know, these recipes are not the kind of recipes that you could probably look at and say, oh, yeah, I'm going home and make a Käsenäpfle tonight. You need to get to know a good German from Russia family, and then hopefully you'll be invited to dinner, and then they will share with you the secrets of how to get that dough just right so it rolls or so that it doesn't pop open when it's boiled in water. So there's tricks to the trade, and there's all kinds of little secrets in here about how to keep your dumplings from falling when you take them out of the pan. And
how do you do that?
Well, you know, you cook them, you kind of steam them, and here's the secret that my aunt told me during an interview. She said, lift the cover off very quickly, because if any of the condensation drops on those dumplings, they'll fall. And you know what? It works.
Oh, those aunts, those great aunts, those grandmas, I think you have really hit the nail on the head here. These are the stories to preserve.
Absolutely.
How long has this project taken you?
Oh, jeepers. You know, I think we began, the Tri-County Tourism Alliance was formed about 2.5 to 3 years ago, and I've been actively seeking recipes, I've been collecting photographs, I've been doing video interviews, we've been making videos, we've been making cooking videos, so it's been about 2 years. We hope to have the complete copy done by the end of March, and then all of the materials that we've collected, which we did get a grant from the North Dakota State Historical Society to help us with the collection. So then we can take these photographs and all of these interviews and all of the DVDs that we've created and put them in each of the counties in their historical society so that somebody 20 years from now can come back and read about these people that came before them. So we're doing two things here. We're doing this beautiful book that we hope will bring a new awareness to people about how much the Germans from Russia contributed to this country's food culture, and then also to preserve some of these things that, you know, when someone dies and you're going through a box and you're not very careful about what you're looking at, you're like, who wants this? And nobody wants it. It gets thrown away, and they're throwing away these recipes and these little handwritten notes, and they're throwing away old photographs that have so much value to some of us.
It's time to preserve them, and people can get their own copies right now, right, with the pre-order?
Yes, we are offering a special pre-publication price on this book. It's 120 pages. It's full color. It's a 12-inch by 12-inch coffee table format. The type is large and easy to read. There's all kinds of photographs in there and all over 100 recipes kind of hidden in the copy and also along the side. There are all kinds of names you'll recognize. And the price right now before May 30th is $50 plus tax and shipping and handling if you need it to be shipped somewhere.
And you can find that ordering information on the archives page for Main Street on prairiepublic.org. And the price after May 30th does go up to $75. And they'll be shipped in late June, just in time for the 125th anniversary of Ashley, North Dakota.
Well, isn't that interesting, Ashley Thornburg? And you'll be back later in the show with what's happening today.
Wouldn't miss it.
Okay. We're going to go to the UND Writers Conference next.
Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Prairie Public is launching a new multimedia project about bullying among kids in North Dakota. But the project needs a name. If you've got an idea, send it to info@prairiepublic.org by email. Whoever comes up with the winner will receive a $25 gift certificate. And don't forget to listen for programming from, well, it could be Project Bully, but that's already taken. Could be the Anti-Bully Project. Now, that one's already taken.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And you've probably been hearing off and on about the UND Writers Conference. It's a really big deal on that campus every early spring. And we've been giving you some samples of the writers, courtesy of graduate students at UND. Well, Heidi Sirwick is going to give us a preview of visiting writer Cheryl Strayed today.
This year, the UND Writers Conference is excited to feature an appearance by author Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl has long been well-respected among her literary peers as an essayist and fiction writer. But two events in 2012, the debut of her memoir Wild on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list, and her unmasking as Sugar, the voice behind the cult status advice column Dear Sugar on therumpus.net, catapulted her to an iconic level. A number of years ago, I had the good fortune to hear Strayed read from a manuscript version of Wild, her story of her mother's death and the subsequent collapse of her marriage, which led her to the decision to do a solo hike of 1,000 miles on the Pacific Coast Trail. I knew then that we would be lucky to host her at this conference. Since then, Wild was selected by Oprah Winfrey to reboot Oprah's Book Club 2.0 and is in development as a film starring Reese Witherspoon and directed by Lisa Chulodenko, who did 2012's The Kids Are All Right. The Dear Sugar columns have been published as the collection Tiny Beautiful Things. And Strayed has embarked on a book tour that has lasted 18 months. I stand by my prediction. We are lucky to have her. Strayed perhaps best explains the source of the woman and the writer she has become in one of her Dear Sugar columns entitled The Obliterated Space. The kindest and most meaningful thing anyone ever says to me is, your mother would be proud of you. Finding a way in my grief to become the woman who my mother raised me to be is the most important way I have honored my mother. It has been the greatest salve to my sorrow. The strange and painful truth is that I'm a better person because I lost my mom young. When you say you experience my writing as sacred, what you are touching is the divine place within me that is my mother. Sugar is the temple I built in my obliterated place. I'd give it all back in a snap, but the fact is, my grief taught me things. It showed me shades and hues I couldn't have otherwise seen. It required me to suffer. It compelled me to reach. Cheryl Strayed will give a reading at the UND Writers Conference on Thursday, March 21st at 8 p.m. in the Memorial Union Ballroom.
That's Heidi Sirwick. She is co-director of the UND Writers Conference. I misspoke. And she's also on the English faculty, assistant professor of literature and creative writing. So I'll apologize to her in person when I go up there next week. What's happening with Ashley is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Thursday's the day that Main Street looks at the rest of the week and next week to tell you what looks interesting out there. Ashley Thornburg's got her list, I've got mine, and let's have at it.
I'm going to start with out in Dickinson, free self-defense series. This is a month-long of Monday classes. The first one is Monday, March 18th at the Beck Auditorium, Kleinfelter Hall, again at Dickinson State University. March 18th, there is kind of a panel discussion, and then on the 25th, you are even learning about drug dogs and all sorts of different self-defense moves. Classes are 7 to 8 p.m. over a one-month time period.
Well, Positively Piano caught my eye, presented by the Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium. It's March 16th, so Saturday night at 7:30, and features pianist Andreas Klein, a fascinating artist with all the indispensable qualities, temperament, taste, touch, tone, the four T's of pianism. That's according to the New York Times. This is, again, Saturday evening at 7:30, admission $14 to $31 at the Belle Mayhus.
In Williston, there is a sports and rec show, and as you might expect, there's going to be camping, biking, fishing, golfing, all sorts of outdoor activities. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Friday 1 to 8, Saturday 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., Sunday 11 to 4, and it is just $5 to enter. But one thing that I really thought was very interesting is that at 1:30 on Saturday, there will also be a talent show. This is a music talent show called the Teddy Talent Trek, and the first place winner will actually be a guest star at the Medora Musical. So kind of a nice twist on your normal sports and rec show.
All right. Well, head to Pekin for the Winter Art Auction presented by the Nelson County Arts Council that begins with wine and hors d'oeuvres at 3 p.m. March 17th. That's Sunday in the Pekin Auditorium in Pekin, followed by a live auction at 4. 31 artists have donated 34 original works of art for the benefit auction. Proceeds help finance the annual Stump Lake Fine Arts Youth Camp in August. The $10 ticket includes a bidding card.
In Minot, the Prairie Quilt Festival. This is an annual quilt show. There's also going to be quilt classes, demonstrations offered by both area and national quilting teachers. It's March 15th, 16th, and 17th. Events throughout the day, really on each of those days, and that is at the Grand International in Minot.
Well, the FM Derby Girls, the roller derby doubleheader, coming to the Fargo Civic Auditorium Saturday. I love this. They call their competitions bouts. The first bout is at 7, the second bout is at 10. It costs $12 to get in. That is Saturday at the Fargo Civic.
Bout is absolutely the right word. Those things are so brutal. I wouldn't last 10 minutes in that. In Valley City, Saturday the 16th, a great time to recycle some old electronics, especially if they are computer related. That's at the Rosebud Visitor Center parking lot. You can drop off computers, keyboards, printers, scanners, really anything computer related. Saturday the 16th of March from 12 to 4 at the Rosebud Visitor Center parking lot.
Well, the Casablanca Orchestra, a 12-piece horn band from Minneapolis, is coming to the Castleton Days Inn tomorrow evening at 8. Costs $18 for the show. It includes hors d'oeuvres. That's the Casablanca Orchestra at the Castleton Days Inn tomorrow night at 8.
This is not confined to just this week. It's actually a series of events, but one of them happens to be coming up soon. The Greater Grand Forks Community Theater has a cure for the winter blahs, and they are offering really just a smorgasbord of theater workshops for you to try out. There's dance and acting techniques, stage makeup, including zombie makeup, which I feel like is what I just do naturally without talent, so I could learn a thing or two. Monologue preparation, intro to playwriting. You're supposed to register by March 20th in order to save 20% on the classes. There are a lot of different classes throughout, so please contact the Greater Grand Forks Community Theater to find out exactly when and where all the different classes are.
The Moorhead Ice Show is Friday and Saturday and Sunday. Friday and Saturday at 7 p.m., Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Moorhead Sports Center. It's featuring Felicia Zhang and Nate Bartholomew. They are U.S. national bronze medalists. It costs adults $6.50 to get into each session, age 4 to 12, $4.50, and younger, free. So the Moorhead Ice Show, Friday and Saturday.
And I've got a couple events that I'm going to put through as event of the week because they are related. You'd think I would have gone with something St. Patrick's Day, but I did not.
I did that.
The Pisanka Egg Show is at the Dickinson's Ukrainian Cultural Institute. The opening is Sunday, March 17th from 1 to 4 p.m. There's going to be cake, but you can also check out the exhibit Monday through Thursday, 9 to 3, or Friday from 9 to 1. And it is a free exhibit to check out Ukrainian egg art. You can also learn to do it yourself in Jamestown Monday and Tuesday. Contact Jamestown Arts for more information.
Okay, well, I went with the obvious. The St. Patrick's Day Parade, downtown Fargo. It's free. It's Saturday at 3 o'clock. Starts with the Lake Agassiz Pacers 5K race and the kids' 800-meter fun run. The parade follows, and it is fun, and it draws a huge crowd.
It
so
really
that's what's
does.
Happening, and we'll be there. Have a great weekend wherever you are, and we'll be back with more in a moment.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 14th. The upbeat weather forecast announced on this date in 1941 proved fatal to dozens along the Red River Valley. North Dakota forecasters predicted light local snows and a possible cold wave for the weekend. But by Saturday night, a deadly blizzard had moved south from Canada and tore through the eastern part of the state, leaving over 60 dead. The enormous number of deaths was largely blamed on the weather forecast, which led many people to make weekend travel plans. Weather records from Fargo's Hector Airport illustrate how quickly the deadly storm moved in. Within an hour, winds increased approximately 60 miles per hour, reaching speeds of up to 80 miles an hour, creating tornado-like conditions. With the addition of blowing snow and ice, several people actually suffocated from the storm. At the time, forecasts for the state were issued from the Federal Weather Bureau in Chicago. A single forecast was issued for the entire state, which local officials would amend depending upon local conditions. Broadcasters along the Red River Valley felt no need to alter the forecast, which called for minor winds and snow. Therefore, many rural residents made their weekly trips into nearby towns for the day. When the weather took a turn for the worst, most families were heading home that evening. This was the case near Fort Ransom, where a father and his son froze to death. Their tracks suggested that the 73-year-old man died first and that his 11-year-old son died while attempting to drag him to safety. A family near Daisy was found the following morning, frozen in place as they tried to reach their farm home, and two cousins near Hannah perished walking home from a 4-H club meeting. The storm proved to be one of the deadliest in the state's history, causing more fatalities than even the Armistice Day blizzard of 1940. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jamie Job. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Friday on Main Street, North Dakota U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp stops by our studio with an update on the goings-on in the nation's capital and, of course, her proposal to count heads again in North Dakota. The census is pretty important for federal reimbursement, and our census has obviously been going up. Also, News Director Dave Thompson will stop by to discuss the week's headlines, and Matt Olean will review Oz the Great and Powerful. That's all happening on Friday on Main Street, and, of course, we look forward to having you with us every day from 3 to 4. And in the meantime, we hope you have a very good evening.